In chapter 12. And we'll be reminded here that just prior to what takes place here, the kingdom of Israel had been divided. There had been three kings of the united kingdom of Israel. Saul had started about 1050 B.C. David had come along about 1010 B.C. And then in 970 B.C. we find that Solomon was a ruler of the kingdom of Israel, the last ruler of the kingdom of Israel as a united kingdom. And the kingdom divided when Rehoboam, his son, became king. All of Israel came to Rehoboam to make him king. And they put out a request for him. They said, be easier on us than your father was. And so he takes counsel of two groups of people. He takes counsel of the older men that had served his father. And then he takes counsel of the younger men who were his peers. And the older man said to him, said, speak good words to them. Speak kind words to the people of Israel and they'll serve you faithfully. He goes to the younger men, and just simply paraphrasing here, the younger men advise him and say, you tell the people of Israel, you just thought my father was hard on you. I'm going to be a lot harder than he was. And so what takes place is 10 of the tribes leaving, the northern tribes. The kingdom of Israel, as it became known as, that has its capital in the city of Samaria, and whose first king is a man by the name of Jeroboam. And what King Rehoboam is left with is the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. And so you have the northern kingdom of Rehoboam, its capital at Samaria, and the southern kingdom of Judah with its capital in the city of Jerusalem, with Rehoboam as the king. And so if we pick up in verse 25 for just a few moments in 1 Kings chapter 12, we see that Rehoboam becomes afraid that when the Israelites return to Jerusalem to worship, that their heart is going to once again be welded with the people there, with the city of Jerusalem, and with the temple and the worship that they were so used to and that God had commanded. And so he changes the religion. He changes the worship. And in fact, in verse 26, it says, now Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. If the people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And so it does a couple of things. First of all, he says, it's too much for you to make that trip. I'm going to make things easier for you. I'm going to provide for you what we would call today a religion of convenience. It's not going to take as much effort. It's not going to take as much travel. And then he does a second thing. He says, I'm going to change some things. I'm going to devise a religion after my own heart. And that's what we see takes place, and it's addressed there in one of the latter verses of 1 Kings chapter 12. And he changes at least four things about the religion that God had given to his people and that he had commanded. He changes the object of worship. They had to worship God and Him alone, and we understand that. And God had commanded that. And they had suffered already because of idolatry and various times that they had wandered off into the sin of idolatry. But He builds two calves. He builds one at Dan in the northern reaches of the kingdom, and then He builds one at Bethel. And if you look at a map, you'll see Bethel is just a few miles north of Jerusalem, but it's in the northern kingdom, whereas Jerusalem is in the southern kingdom. And He says, we see in verse 28, He said, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Let me ask you a question just for a moment. Do those words sound familiar? Behold your God, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. If you turn back, and we won't do it right now, but if you turn back to Exodus chapter 32, these are the same words that Aaron had pronounced when he built the golden calf while Moses was on Mount Sinai. And you remember how they suffered and how God punished them on that occasion. And obviously, Jeroboam didn't learn or he didn't remember that lesson from history. And so he changed the object of worship. He changed the place of worship from Jerusalem to Dan and Bethel. We have here, we're told that he made a house. He built a temple on the high places. We're told that he changed the priesthood. He took the lowest of the people rather than those of the tribe of Levi that God had commanded. And then he changed the day of a feast, as we see here. And God obviously was displeased with that. God is displeased when we try to change things concerning the worship that He has given us today. We're to be obedient to God in the matter of worship. In John chapter 4 and verse 24, there Jesus said, God is a spirit. Now they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. There's an interesting statement made by the inspired writer in the book of Colossians in chapter 2 and verse 23, which really describes what Jeroboam had done here and what so many do today when they change the things that God has ordained for our worship today. Whether or not they change the observance of the Lord's Supper, the frequency, the day that it's observed, or they introduce instrumental music, or some other facet that God has commanded that they either ignore or that they add something to. Colossians chapter 2, and here verse 23. Here the Apostle Paul is writing about those who are teaching and following after various doctrines and ordinances of men. And he said, which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will, worship, and humility. And he goes on there. But the phrase that I want us to think about, and you may be reading from a translation that offers a little bit different phrasing of that, the King James Version there uses the word will worship. What that really means is we like it, worship, somebody said. This is what we like. And so this is what we're going to do. Jeroboam was doing what he liked rather than what God had commanded. And so God is so displeased with that. That's a lesson we already learned when we read Genesis 4, isn't it? And we see the example there of Cain and Abel. One offered an acceptable sacrifice and the other didn't. Abel did, and Cain didn't, obviously. And God is pleased with Abel, and He's so displeased with Cain. We see that earlier in Leviticus chapter 10, when the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, failed to offer the kind of fire that God had instructed. And fire comes down from heaven and consumes them. And so what we see is we turn over into the 13th chapter. And by the way, you'll notice there in that last verse in chapter 12, that is verse 33, that these doings, this religion that Jeroboam had begun there in the nation of Israel is described as being devised of his own heart. Where again, you may have a translation that renders that with a slightly different wording, but that's the import of it. This has not come from the mind of God. This hasn't come from the commandments of God, but it's come from his own heart. This is what he wanted to do. This is the way he sought to make it more convenient for the people of now the 10 tribes of the nation of Israel. And so chapter 13 begins with this word in the King James Version. And behold, the next translation there says, just as. That is, Jeroboam was about to burn incense on the altar. And just as he is about to do that, a man of God, a prophet, appears on the scene out of Judah. And so he had gone from Judah up under the little city of Bethel there, again just north of the city of Jerusalem. And he begins to cry out against the altar there, and he pronounces the word of the Lord, a condemnation of God because of the sin that is being committed. And his words are in verse 2, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah by name. And upon thee shall he offer the priest of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burnt upon thee. What the man of God out of Judah is saying there, what this prophet is saying there is this. These priests that you've appointed who are offering these sacrifices to these idols that you have erected, and this is going to be over 200 years later, over 250 years later, in fact, close to about 290 years later, that Josiah becomes king. And he's already naming Josiah, and he said he's going to burn those priests on this altar. And we see that in 2 Kings chapter 23. That they go into the sepulcher there when Josiah is bringing about a restoration of the worship of God and the will of God, and they take those bones and they burn them on the altar. Well, that outrages, we find here, King Jeroboam. And the prophet had said this. He said, God's going to give a sign that this is going to take place. He said, this altar is going to split and these ashes are going to be poured out. And we see that as the King Jeroboam hears him saying these things, that he reaches forth his hand. He says, in essence, taking, seizing. And as he reaches his hand out, it withers up. The altar is split and the ashes are poured out, and he changes his tune very quickly, doesn't he? He says, pray ye to the Lord for me that my hand might be restored. But I want to make a point as we think about a couple of things right here and before we go any further. First of all, in contrast to the corruption of King Jeroboam, we see the courage of this man of God out of Judah, this young prophet, as he's described, and later described. We see the courage to cry out against sin and against wickedness. And it didn't matter that he was decrying against the king as he was doing that. Think with me just for a moment. Some other individuals that had the courage to do that kind of thing. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5, we read there of Noah before the days of the flood. And we're told this about him. Speaking of the flood, it says, and spared, or God rather, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. And as we look there in Genesis chapter 6, that begins to talk about Noah and how wicked that the world had become. It looks like there's a period of about 120 years that Noah is crying out against the sin and immorality and the violence and the evil. Every imagination of their hearts was only evil continually. Imagine preaching, teaching, trying to reach people for 120 years and you don't reach a single person. The only person, the only people that you save, they're the members of your family. That's quite an accomplishment, isn't it? They're the members of your family. But nobody else outside of that. But he has the courage to continue doing that. 2 Samuel chapter 12. We have, and we won't necessarily turn over there. Well, there's a prophet by the name of Nathan who goes to David. After David had committed a series of sins in connection with his adultery with the wife of Uriah the Hittite, a woman by the name of Bathsheba, he had taken her and had committed adultery with her and had sent a note by that same man's hand that resulted in his death in battle. And he tried a number of things to cover up his sin. And some time has passed. And God sends a prophet by the name of Nathan to him. And Nathan begins to speak to David and he tells him a parable, doesn't he? He tells him a story that he can put beside his own situation. He says there were two men living in one city, the one rich and the other was poor. He said the rich man had a traveler, had a guest who came by, and he takes the one little ewe lamb away from the poor man. And he said he had raised that ewe lamb like a child. He nourished it. You know, you could see him holding it in his arms. And he said he took that lamb and he prepared it as a meal for this guest. And so as he's relating this, David becomes angry. He says, the man that hath done this thing, he said, he shall die. And he shall restore fourfold what he's taken away. And it continues just a little bit there. And what does Nathan say? He said, you are the man. There's the courage to cry out against sin and against wickedness. And we can refer to others, and you're familiar with the way that John the Baptist cried out against Herod, who had taken his brother Philip's wife. In Matthew chapter 14 and verse 4, he said, it's not lawful for you to have her. It takes quite a bit of courage, doesn't it? He's not only the king, he's in a marriage relationship that's not in accord with God's word. He's living with a woman that he had taken from his brother Philip. And he said, it's not lawful for you to have her. And we could talk about others, such as Stephen, Acts chapter 7. You remember there, before Stephen is stoned, the thing that brings that on is he's preaching and he's condemning those who were listening, those unbelieving Jews, as having slain the Son of God. They gnashed on him with their teeth, and they stoned him to death. But we see that the king says, restore my arms. Pray to God that this take place. And he does. And his arm is restored. And then once again, the king's tune changes, as we see. And he offers the young man, he says, come home with me. Eat with me. He says, I want to feed you. And so, you see beginning there in about verse 6 of the 13th chapter, it says, and the king answered and said unto the man of God, entreat now. Well, let's move on down to verse 7 rather. And the king said unto the man of God, come home with me and refresh thyself, and I will give thee a reward. The man of God said unto the king, if thou wilt give me half thine house, I will not go in with thee. Neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so it was charged me by the word of the Lord, saying, eat no bread nor drink water, nor turn again by the same way that thou camest. So he went another way, and he returned not the way that he came to Bethel. God had given this young prophet, this man of God out of Judah, a charge as well concerning his trip there, concerning where he was to eat and where he was to drink. And it was a very understandable commandment, wasn't it? The king says, come home and eat with me. And the young man says, if you were to give me half of your kingdom, he said, I wouldn't do that because this is what God told me. He said, don't eat bread here, don't drink water here, and don't return by the way that you came. And as we approach the verses that we read at the outset this evening, we learn there's an older prophet in the city of Bethel, and he learns through his sons what has taken place here. And it's apparent that he has some admiration for this younger prophet. And so he says, "Saddle my donkey." Which way did he go? And so he goes after the young man to bring him back to his house. In verse 14 it says, "And after the man of God, and went after the man of God, and found him sitting under an oak. And he said unto him, Art thou the man of God that camest from Judah? And he said, I am." And then verse 15, looking at some verses that we read, that Mike read earlier, says, "Then he said unto him, Come home with me, and eat bread. And he said, I may not return with thee, nor go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water with thee in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, Thou shalt eat no bread nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou camest. And he said unto him, I am a prophet also as thou art. And an angel spake unto me by the word of the Lord, saying, Bring him back with thee into thine house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied unto him." He lied to him. And we see the effect of that lie as we go on down. Beginning in the 19th verse, it says, "So he went back with him, and he did eat bread in his house and drink water. And it came to pass, as they sat at the table, that the word of the Lord came unto the prophet that brought him back. And he cried unto the man of God that came from Judah, saying, Thus saith the Lord, Forasmuch as thou hast disobeyed the mouth of the Lord, and hast not kept the commandment which the Lord thy God commanded thee, but came back and hast eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which the Lord did say unto thee, Eat no bread and drink no water, thy carcass shall not come into the sepulchre of thy fathers." And we recall perhaps as he heads back to his home or toward his home, he saddles his donkey and he begins to go back. Verse 24 says, "And when he was gone, a lion met him by the way and slew him, and his carcass was cast in the way. And the donkey stood by. The lion also stood by the carcass." Well, the old prophet learns of this, and he goes and he retrieves the body of this younger prophet, and he buries it in his own tomb. He buries it in his own grave, we're told, on around verses 29 and 30. It says, "And the prophet took up the carcass of the man of God, and laid it upon the donkey, and brought it back. And the old prophet came to the city to mourn and to bury him. And he laid his carcass in his own grave, and they mourned over him, saying, Alas, my brother. And it came to pass after he had buried him that he spake to his son, saying, When I am dead, then bury me in the sepulchre wherein the man of God is buried, lay my bones beside his bones." But I want us to go back for just a few minutes before we conclude this evening and look at this expression that we find in verse 18. The last few words says, "But he lied unto him." One of the things that we learn from this is the fact that a lie believed can produce the same feelings as the truth when it's accepted. That we can't simply operate, we can't simply act upon the basis of the way that we feel. Somebody says, "Well, I know I'm right because I feel like I'm right. I know that I'm right because I have a certain feeling in my heart. I'm happy, I'm joyful." Well, look with me, if you would, just for a minute. Turning back to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37th chapter. I think we see a great example of what we're trying to say. An illustration of it here. You remember after the brothers of Joseph had sold him into slavery. They had sold him to the slave traders who came along. They took his coat and they dipped his coat in the blood of a goat. And they bring it to their father Jacob. Verse 33 of Genesis chapter 37 says, "And they bring the coat, and they're still being so duplicitous, they're still being so deceptive. And they said, We found this coat, we don't know whether it be thy son's coat or not," back in verse 32. "And he knew it and said, It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days." And what we understand is this. Jacob would have not felt any different had that actually been true, would he? That lie that he believed produced the same feelings within his heart, within his soul, that it would have if it had actually been the truth. But the fact that he felt a certain way the fact that he mourned, the fact that later he said, I'll go to the grave mourning my son, didn't make it true. What we learn as we look at the Word of God is the fact that truth must come first. That what we do must be upon the basis of what the Word of God has to say, and then feelings will follow that. Let's look at an example of that. If you return with me to Acts the 8th chapter. Acts chapter 8. We go a little bit further. And we see this familiar conversion account where Philip preaches to the Ethiopian eunuch who is returning to his home. And he preaches Jesus to him, beginning at the text in Isaiah chapter 53, where we see there that he's reading. And Philip baptizes the eunuch. He obviously learns the necessity, the importance of baptism as Philip preaches Christ, and beginning at that text. And so verse 38 says in chapter 8, and he commanded the chariot to stand still, and they went down both into the water, both Philip and the eunuch, and he baptized him. And when they were come up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord called away Philip, that the eunuch saw him no more, and he went on his way rejoicing. Look at the simple pattern there. Look at the simple procedure. He learns the truth, he obeys the truth, and then the feelings follow. The feelings are produced. It's not a matter of him feeling a certain way and assuming he's saved, but it's a matter of actually learning and obeying the truth and then rejoicing, because that's what really has happened. There's a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Solomon tells us in the book of Proverbs. As we turn back over to 1 Kings chapter 12, we think about the fact that Jeremiah, in the 10th chapter, Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23, he had warned against simply following after our own way, our own thinking. He said there, O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It's not in man that walketh to direct his steps. But the second point I want to make here before we move on to one more point this evening, or final point this evening, is this. Here's a man who says, I'm a prophet. Here's a man who says, an angel revealed this to me. There are people today who believe that perhaps they've had some kind of vision that an angel has spoken to them. I've had conversations with people before who believe that they had some kind of supernatural sort of revelation, who actually believe that an angel had spoken to them. But this is what the Apostle Paul has to say about that. Galatians chapter 1, beginning there in verse 6 and looking at some things going down through verse 9. Galatians, the first chapter, beginning here in verse 6 and going through verse 9. Here, the Apostle Paul, as he's warning these Christians in the churches of Galatia against false teaching, he says, if you hear anything, if anybody or anyone or even an angel were to say something to you that is different from what the gospel teaches, different from what the Word of God has to say, that one stands accursed, stands condemned. Beginning in verse 6 of Galatians 1, the writer says, I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. As we said before, so say I now again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that ye have received, let him be accursed. What's the lesson? We're not simply to take the word of some man. We're not simply to take the word if some man were to come along and say, well, I've received some kind of a spirit-endowed revelation, or an angel has revealed this to me. What we're to take is the word of God. We're to be like those in Berea. Acts chapter 17 and verse 11, who are more noble than those in Thessalonica in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the Scriptures daily whether those things were so. But he said he believed the lie, and we see the consequences then of his disobedience. Turning back just for a minute to 1 Kings chapter 12 and 1 Kings chapter 13, rather, I want to think about the fact that there are a lot of lies in the religious realm today. And the consequences of believing those lies are spiritual death, spiritual separation. For example, there is a very prevalent lie, and it's not necessarily, it's in a sense in the religious world, it deals with the religious thing, that simply says there is no God. There is no God. And so the inference is there's no reason to be concerned about spiritual things, about being saved, about things such as heaven and hell and eternal life. The psalmist says in Psalms chapter 14, verse 1, the fool had said in his heart, there is no God. And then speaks of the departure from the truth, the disobedience, that kind of false human philosophy leads to. Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, Romans the first chapter, beginning in verse 18, the writer Paul says here, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold, that is, who handle the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him, from or that is since the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Here the Apostle Paul says, one who would deny the existence of God has no excuse for that state of ignorance, for that state of denial. And then again, there are those who might say, well, there is a God, but He doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about humankind. He doesn't have any interest in this world. A more proper term for that would be one who is a deist, who says, in essence, well, there was a God who created, and then He just stepped back to see how things were going to play out, kind of like somebody winding up a watch and then watching it unwind. Rather than that, we find the Scriptures teaching us that God has so many times and so bountifully bestowed His goodness upon us. For example, in Acts chapter 14 and verse 17, here we find the preaching of Paul at Lystra, and he's proclaiming the God, he says here, who left not Himself without witness, in that He did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Or as James proclaims in James the first chapter in verse 17, he says there, going back to verse 16, do not err, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. And then Paul reminds us in Romans chapter 8, Romans the 8th chapter in verse 32, concerning the unsparing nature of God in the spiritual realm. I want to back up to verse 32, verse 31, then read verse 32. The writer says, what shall we say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him also freely give us all things? And so there's the lie that says there is no God. There's the lie that says there is a God, but He doesn't care about you. And then there's the lie that goes to the opposite extreme and says, God is going to save everybody. It doesn't matter how you live. Even the most evil and most vile of persons is going to be saved. That's the doctrine of universalism. And it's refuted over and over again, counted in the Scriptures. For example, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 14, for many are called, but few are chosen. Or even in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 7, beginning there in verse 13 and going through verse 14, Jesus implored His hearers here. He issues an invitation by saying, enter ye in at the straight gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Here Jesus in His teaching said, many are going to be lost in comparison with the few who were saved. There's the lie in the religious world, and one of the most prominent lies. And by the way, if you go back and think about Genesis chapter 3, the devil is the father of lies. That says one is saved by faith only, by just simply believing. No active obedience at all is essential. James chapter 2 and verse 24, here we find the writer James, and he's talking about the necessity of faith and works. And he says in James 2 and verse 24, you see then how that by works a man is justified, and not by faith only. In fact, in verse 26, he compares the idea of faith without works, he says, by saying, for as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. Here we see James makes the point that there are acts of obedience that are essential for salvation. The only time that the expression faith only occurs in our English translations is in this verse here, and it says, not by faith only. And then again, there are those who would tell the lie, well, an infant is subject to baptism. And so there's a baptism that may be necessary, but an infant can be baptized. An infant should be baptized. Jesus said this. We think about this in Mark chapter 16 and verses 15 and 16. And of course, as we look at the cases of conversion, as perhaps you're turning over there, we see that in every case we see men and women who are able to hear and believe and understand facts and understand the nature of their sin being converted. But beginning in verse 15 of Mark chapter 16, rather, Jesus gives this great commission to His disciples, and He says, go ye to all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Who are the creatures? The question was asked in our class this morning. Who are the creatures that are subject to the preaching of the gospel? Well, in verse 16 says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. We see that those to whom the gospel is addressed, or who are subjects for obedience to the gospel, are those who are capable of hearing and believing and weighing evidence and making choices. That doesn't include infants, does it? Certainly not. And then finally this evening, let's talk about one more lie just briefly. There's the lie that says it's impossible to fall from grace. Once you're saved, you're always saved. You don't have to be concerned about how you live. You don't have to be concerned about faithfulness. Because once you're saved, there's no way that you can be lost. Among many texts that we could look at that would address that particular religious lie, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12, we find here the Apostle Paul issuing a warning when he says, wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Let's address to all of us. We can fall. We can lose our salvation. There'd be no need for the warning if there were no danger. Those that Paul writes to in Galatians, the 5th chapter and verse 4, are addressed in these terms. He says, Christ is become of no effect unto you. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, that is those who are seeking to be justified by going back to the law of Moses, he said, ye are fallen from grace. Here are some who had done that because they had departed from the teaching of the gospel. And then finally this evening in Hebrews chapter 3, we find here in the 12th verse, the writer says, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Once again, a warning that says it's possible to fall from grace. The writer in 1 Kings chapter 13, as he describes the events later on in the life of this young prophet, as the older prophet is talking to him, he says, I'm a prophet like you are. An angel has spoken to me. Come on back with me. Eat bread. Drink water at my house. But he lied to him. The possibility of believing a lie and the consequences of doing things. Jesus said, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. John chapter 8 and verse 32. The truth this evening is that if you're here and have never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, you stand before God as an accountable individual, that one day you're going to stand before Him in judgment and give an account for what you've done with His Word, with His gospel, with the death and sacrifice of His Son, Jesus Christ. We need to recognize that as those who are His children. We're going to stand before Him and give an account for faithfulness or unfaithfulness, how we've lived our lives before Him. Are you ready for that great day? If you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, you've done the things that are essential to be saved from your past sins. We're living faithfully as God would have us to do. There are corrections that need to be made. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing this evening?